Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
I'm Shannon. I'm an alcoholic.
We love you, Shannon. Lots and lots and lots. And lots.
Thank you guys so much for that warm welcome. So young but not new. First of all, I really like to thank everybody who thinks that I'm young because I've been wearing wrinkle cream for the past 2 years, so I'm really excited that I'm still in that bracket. I'd also like to thank all the volunteers and everyone that's helped put this weekend together, because I don't know about you guys, but I've had a phenomenal time thus far. Thank you guys. So I'll go ahead and start out. My sobriety date is April 21st of 2002. I was 15 when I got sober, so I'm just going to go ahead and qualify a little bit so that you guys know that I'm actually an alcoholic and haven't just been hanging out here for the past, 13 years just because. I come from a really Catholic, a really Irish, and really alcoholic family. I can remember having my first drink when I was probably about 3 years old, and drinking just was kind of not a big deal for us to do when we were kids. So that's kind of how I grew up, and didn't really see anything the matter with it. And I don't really remember getting drunk, though, until I can remember my first drink was like at three. I don't remember getting drunk at three. I don't really remember a lot about being three in general. So I can't really say much about that. But I can remember the first time I got drunk. I was about 11 years old. My older sister was drinking with her friends, and so they thought that it'd be really cute to get me drunk, and I also thought that was adorable. So I drank, and that phenomenon of craving came over, right? Like, I could feel it go down my throat, and that warm sensation hits my stomach, and it just radiates out. And all of that fear and all of that worry that I had just went away. It just went away. And if you know what that feels like, then I think you're in the right spot, the book talks a lot about how I couldn't control and enjoy my drinking, and that's exactly what it was like from that moment on. I blacked out the first time I got drunk, and constantly thought of ways that I could capture that feeling again. And I really used drinking as a solution, really, to all of my problems, right? Like, that's exactly what it was for a while, until it tried to kill me. it was my solution. I tried to get it as often as I could. Being 11, it's really hard to, like, walk into a bar and be like, hey, how's it going, So you had to get really creative with it. My mom was also drinking at this time, so that was really helpful. Things got bad when she got sober. She got sober when I was about 14 years old. I was a freshman in high school, and I thought that was a horrible idea, but she didn't ask my opinion. So she got about 6 months sober and realized that I might have a problem, and so she decided to take me into a treatment center and do a little assessment to see if I had a drinking problem or not. I lied and I cried, like, big alligator tears, and I'm not a pretty crier. They still recommended that I do an outpatient treatment program, and I was shocked. I was shocked because I had lied, I didn't tell you how much I really drink, and you still think I need help? Are you joking? Like, that's not okay. So there the seed was planted of AA, and I have many family members who are in AA as well. AA was kind of always in the background, and I didn't really know much about it, but I knew you guys had, like, your own special language that you used, and you used words like sponsor and like, oh, just keep coming back, or live and let live, and I didn't know what any of that meant, and I thought that was crazy. So we'll fast forward a year. a year later, I hit bottom. And I think that's one thing I think that's hard for people to get is, how do you hit bottom at 15? Well, I'll tell you. I was suicidal and homicidal. That's how. I had been saying a prayer for months prior to the time I got sober for God just to take me, because I couldn't continue the way that I was living anymore. I couldn't see myself continuing to drink, but I also couldn't see myself ever not drinking. That was not really an option. The book talks about that as being at the jumping off place, and that's exactly where I was. I was not taking care of myself at all. The things that were important to me became not important to me. I was horrible to my family. I was losing a lot of friends, and I really just didn't understand. Like, I had changed friends over the course of my drinking career, mainly because I didn't understand why you didn't want to keep drinking after a night of drinking. I didn't understand that. They were like, oh, let's take a breather. And I'm like, no, bro, let's go. Like, come on, right now. And apparently, normal 14-year-old drinkers don't drink that way, so that was kind of odd. So I finally hit bottom and was suicidal, and my mom ended up walking in, and I had a knife to my wrists, and I was just praying for the courage, and the courage was not coming. You know, that was one prayer that God just said no to. So she asked at that point if I wanted help, and I said yes, and I was at that point willing to go to any length to not feel the way that I felt at that moment, to not have to continue living with this disease anymore in its ugliest of states. So I went to treatment. I went to a 30-day inpatient facility, and I'm from Nashville, so it was in Nashville. And after that, they talked a lot about in there about this halfway house idea. And I thought that was kind of silly when I first heard about it. And then my mom came and made me really upset. And I was like, so tell me about this halfway house. So I don't have to live at home? Oh, great. I'll do that. And so they told me about two adolescent halfway houses. The closest female adolescent halfway houses were 9 hours away from Nashville, Tennessee, and in the great state of Louisiana, and in a small, small town called Denham Springs. So they told me about these two halfway houses. You could smoke in one of them and you couldn't in the other. So I went with smoking, and that's really where I got sober, you know. And the people down in Louisiana, they introduced me to things like sponsorship. They introduced me to the concept of they'd really rather hurt my feelings than kill me, and I appreciated that. They didn't treat me differently because I was young. Now, I did hear a lot of meetings like, oh, you are so lucky to get it when you're so young. You know, that's amazing. And that kind of irritated me when I first heard that, you know, because I'm like, do you think I just didn't hit bottom? Is that what you think? You know, I might have been a little standoffish even now. I know that's shocking. but I understand what they're saying now, you know, like I kind of get it. I only had a few bad times with people like saying comments that, oh, well, you know, I spilt more liquor than you drank. And my response to that was, well, maybe if you didn't spill so much, you would have gotten here sooner. And so we got to be really good friends. But I am grateful that you guys accepted me in all of my sickness, because I was completely unlovable when I got here. And you accepted me with open arms, and I'm so, so incredibly grateful for this fellowship for that and for not treating me differently. Because I did learn in here that to be different is a death sentence for me. I've got to realize that I am no different than anyone else in this fellowship. So that's where I got sober. I came back to Nashville after about 7 months down there. Promptly forgot just about everything I learned down there, and got a boyfriend the first week and got a sponsor the second week. So I had to have my priorities. The boyfriend only lasted for a few weeks, but the sponsor ended up lasting for about 7 years, so that's pretty awesome. so um, So yeah, and but I had kind of forgotten what I learned down there, and I stepped away from service work. In Louisiana, I got involved in my home group, and I made coffee, and I cleaned up ashtrays, and cleaned up after the meeting, and greeted people, and I kind of forgot to do that, back home in Nashville, and kind of stepped away, I just stepped away for a few years, and was still sober, was still going to meetings, but I kind of slowly turned meetings into, like, social hour, you know? Because at 16, 17, 18 years old, you know, spiritual progress wasn't necessarily real high on my priority list a lot of the time, you know? it's hard to maintain all that for me anyways. So kind of what drove me back into service and back into the rooms, to the service of the rooms, I should say, that other legacy that I had kind of forgotten about, was I met this really cute boy, and this really cute boy, and I started dating, and he was about to go to his home group business meeting, and he was like, do you want to come? Because I know you're going to come to the meeting later. Like, do you just want to come to the business meeting before? It just makes sense, you know, like, because we're probably going to hang out afterwards, too. And I was like, well, yeah, economically, that makes the most sense. So I'll go. So I go to this business meeting, and there was about four people in the meeting, and they didn't have a treasurer. And so they said, hey, do you want to be treasurer? And I was like, are you sure? Are you positive? You want me to be treasurer? And they're like, yeah, we think you'll be fine. So I walked out of the of the business meeting as the treasurer for this home group that I had somehow became a member of during that meeting. And and yeah, that's kind of what got me back into the service structure. So I got involved with my home group. I was became GSR for that home group a couple years later and started going to my district meetings and started going to my area assembly. And started to really get involved. You know, I started getting involved with young people's service as well. I started going to my state young people's conference, TIKIPA. That's pretty awesome conference, y'all, in case you ever want to go. So I went there. I put in a bid for CIRCUPA, and we got CIRCUPA one year, and was a member of the host committee for that. And as James alluded to, I am now currently on the bid committee for the Tennessee bid for the 58th ICIPA. Represent. And I've been on that committee now, I guess, for about 7 years, and that's been such a huge life-changing experience for me, you know. And one of the great parts about being young and sober and so excited about all this stuff is getting to be a part of that and getting to be a part, watching people grow up in the rooms, you know. I kind of literally grew up in the rooms, not I didn't grow any height wise, unfortunately, but still struggling to reach 5 feet, but just kind of growing up in the rooms, and one of my favorite lines that in the 12 and 12 right now is on page 38, and I love it so much because this is exactly how I got here, and this is exactly how I live my life sometimes. So it says, so it is by circumstance rather than by any virtue that we have been driven to AA, have admitted defeat, have acquired the rudiments of faith, and now want to make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to a higher power. And I love that, you know, because, like, that's exactly how my life in AA is. It's a lot of the things that I choose to do are by circumstance, not because of virtue. You know, like, I didn't get here because, like, oh, I feel kind of bad. Maybe I'm drinking too much. I should just come to AA. No, I came here because my butt was on fire, you know, like I was about to die. That's why I came here. Any spiritual progress that I make, like something tough is going on. And so that's what makes me grow spiritually a little more, you know. I wish I could tell you that I meditate for hours every day, and that's just because it's the right thing to do. And unfortunately, that's not. It's normally because I know the consequences if I don't do that. You know, if I don't do my prayer and I don't do my meditation and I don't meet with my sponsor or meet with my sponsees, I know the consequences behind that. And I'm just not really willing to live that way anymore. I know the consequences of my AA life without service, and I'm not willing to go back there anymore. You know, I was selling myself short, I think, for those few years that I wasn't involved in AA or in service, excuse me. One of the great things about getting sober young is that I get to have these really big life events sober, you know. So that cute boy that I told you about, we got married. We've been married now, it'll be 4 years in October. And about 4 months ago, we had a lovely little boy. He's so cute. Thank you. He's currently snoozing, so let's not clap too loud. but yeah, you know, like, and it was just so amazing to be able to be there sober, you know, and to bring my higher power into the rooms while we were, you know, definitely while we were getting married, and then also when we were having him, you know. And it was one of those experiences that God just had to get bigger. And I'm so grateful for that time, you know. And, you know, I think it's funny too. I'll tell this little story. So when I was pregnant, you know, like I did this nice little birth plan, and like, you know, got really spiritual, and I was like, all right, God, I think this is really how I think this should happen. And God just kind of looked at me and was like, that is so cute. That is just adorable that you think that that's going to happen that way. Because I was like, you know, yeah, we'll be in and out of this labor deal like 5 hours probably, right? Like, yeah, it'll be totally fine. We're going to go all natural. We're going to do like an hour of skin to skin afterwards. And like, it's going to, you know, no drugs at all, like nothing. About 8 hours in, I got the epidural. And about 12 hours after that, he was finally born. So God definitely got bigger in that moment, you know, and those wee hours of the morning. And and yeah, you know, like I wanted all these things for after the delivery. And God was like, no, that's just not how that's going to happen. We had some complications along the way. And so there was, you know, about 30 people in the room, you know, in this really intimate setting. And they had like 5 or 6 NICU nurses in there, you know, like, and so that hour of skin to skin, like, I didn't see my baby when he came out, you know. They brought him over there and he was instantly surrounded by a whole bunch of nurses. I haven't talked about this yet, so it's a little new. And then I heard his cry, and I just knew at that moment that everything was okay, you know. Thank you. But God just got bigger in that moment, you know, and it became really real, and really, I just knew that God had it taken care of, you know, like, and despite all that, with all the complications, I knew that God was with me the entire time. I did learn that I could not look at my family's face during it because their faces were mortified, so I just looked at the ceiling. But, you know, God just got bigger in that moment, and I'm so grateful that I was able to do a lot of spiritual progress on the front end for those big life events that you know are going to happen, you know. And then after we had him too, you know, my husband and I had to determine he's an AA as well, and so we had to figure out meeting schedules and how we're going to do that, and how we're both going to be involved with service, and those are still conversations that we have today. Like, how are we going to get our meditation in the morning? How am I going to say my prayers in the morning? Because it used to be I just rolled out of bed and prayed. Well, now I'm rolling out of bed because my baby's screaming because he's starving, you know. So it's just an adjustment of how life will look in these new phases of my life. And I'm so grateful that I can be sober for all of those phases, you know. I'm so grateful that he doesn't have to see his mom drunk right now. Like, that's awesome. And I hope that continues to be the case. You know, I know that if I continue to live the way that I've lived for the past little bit, then I know that that will be the case. And I'm so grateful for that. Yeah. Yeah, I think I have about a minute left, but I can't think of anything else to say. So thank you guys so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Shannon. That was spectacular. I am just overwhelmed with the amount of gratitude in that story. It's one of the things that I love about listening to people that got sober young is the opportunity to do so much with those years and the amount of gratitude that usually comes out of that. Thank you. Our next speaker is Gwen from Burlington, Vermont. You got some fans in the audience. Now, I asked Gwen earlier what I should say to introduce her, and she said that she wanted me to tell you guys to prepare to have your minds blown. Now, she might have been joking, but she's got a grapevine, so maybe not. But I'm really excited to hear what she has to say. So with that, I'm going to give you Gwen from Burlington.
I'm Gwen. I'm an alcoholic. I love you too. I do. I love Alcoholics Anonymous and the life you've given me. And it was so unlikely. And it's funny that you actually said that about the mind-blowing thing. I apologize if it's wildly anticlimactic. But you know what? My spiritual awakenings are kind of like that. And I have had and continue to have spiritual awakenings as a result of the framework of recovery that Alcoholics Anonymous has put in my life. And it's hard to talk about those spiritual experiences because they're so internal, and yet the change is vast and incredible. And it was so unlikely. It was impossible. I have a sobriety date, May 17th of 2009. I have a home group, the Girls Night Out meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hey, home group member! It meets at 6:30 at the Turning Point in Burlington, Vermont. If you're ever in town, please, please, please come by. I have a sponsor. I just got a new sponsor, and that's exciting. And I have the opportunity to also work with other women in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's pretty wild to be standing up here at the International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous, 80th anniversary. It's incredible on a number of different reasons, but for me, it's the fact that you guys were always there. Alcoholics Anonymous, for the entire length of my being, you guys have been there. Amidst all the darkness, amidst all the weird stuff that I did and that happened, Alcoholics Anonymous was there and waiting to hold me when I was ready. And I didn't know I was ready. Nor did I want to be ready. For most of my life, I felt like Shel Silverstein wrote a book called Where the Sidewalk Ends. And on the cover, there's these kids looking over the end of a sidewalk. And that's always kind of how I felt. I was looking over the side of the sidewalk, and there's nothing good down there, you know? And later on in my drinking, I ended up living off the side of the sidewalk in that pit and abyss. And my early drinking was mostly funnish. I had consequences from the start. Most of them were external. So I built up that resume, and alcohol gave me an identity, the identity I had been looking for. I was always kind of like, I realize this now, thank you for this realization. I was always kind of mediocre, just, I wish I was like the one who was like top of the list on everything. I was okay, you know, like I was okay in school. I was in smart classes, but I wasn't like anybody to write home about. You weren't writing home about my soccer playing, nothing like that, you know? And alcohol, when I found alcohol, I was maybe 13 or 14, and I was in Ocean City, Maryland with my friends, and, you know, cops showed up at the party. We were hanging out with these guys who were like, they lied and said they were in their 20s. I mean, I'm 13, right? And they lied and said they were in their 20s. God knows how old they actually were. And, you know, the cops show up, and you know, we leave, and there's a noise complaint, and, you know, my friend is vomiting on the inside of the hotel wall, and our parents are on the other side, and we woke up terribly hungover, and I loved it. That was exactly the glamour I had been looking for, you know? It was something. It was something out of the ordinary for me, and that became the ordinary. So for the next couple of years, I build up my external consequences resume. I got arrested. I was in hospitals. And I was grounded all the time. And I thought it was cute. I thought that this was cute. And this was what, you know, fun party girls do. And then my alcoholism started taking on some more epic proportions. And the consequences stopped being, I stopped being able to ignore them. They were lines in the sand that I crossed, right? Excuse the you know, metaphor that we use. But I would say things like, so I was graduating from high school, and I was going to do this prestigious thing after high school. That actually made it go off. Thank you. And I got in, and I was going to do this thing, and I had to go through a process, and I didn't go through the process because of my drugs and alcohol use, and as a result, I didn't do this thing after high school that I had always said I was going to do. And my disease tells me a lot of stories, and the story that it told me was that, like, it got complicated, right? There were medical records that got mixed up, and whatever. It was crazy. And I believed that story. In sobriety, it was like a little while into sobriety when I realized, no, that's not actually what happened. I didn't follow through. Like, that period, that was the end. But my alcoholism tells me these stories, and I collect a lot of evidence to support those stories that are utterly untrue. And you guys are there, thank God, telling me these stories aren't true, and you're helping me collect this other evidence. But I need you guys for that. And of course, I didn't have you when I was out, and yet you were always there. So my drinking got weirder and darker. The things that were happening were weirder and darker. And if you're sitting in the room, you know what I'm talking about. You know what I mean? Like, they always say, you know, we didn't fly in on the wings of victory. And I certainly did not. You know, what happened was that the end of my drinking was boring. It was boring, and after thousands of dollars of outside help, it turns out boring is not boring for me. It's actually hopelessness. But it always felt like boring. And it was the same stuff all the time. And on January 2nd of 2009, I woke up in a compromised situation. None of the details were new. What was new was two things. I had lost a significant amount of time, and I was always a blackout drinker. But I had, the last thing I remember is December 30th, maybe, 31st, who knows. But I had lost a significant amount of time, and I would usually gray in and then selectively forget the rest. And I was unable to do that. I couldn't recollect anything that had happened. And when I started hearing what had happened, again, none of those details were new. Not a single thing that happened in that time was new. What was new was that I had this feeling in the pit of my being that said, this isn't okay anymore. And that was really scary, because if that wasn't okay anymore, I had no idea what was. I had no idea what was. So I talked to a friend about what had happened. I was scared. And she said, well, are you going to go to a meeting? And I'm like, what meeting? What meeting? What are you talking about, meeting? And then she said, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have no idea how I found my first meeting. It's perplexing to me, other than I was supposed to find it because there's a higher power in looking out for me. And so I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was pretty wild. We speak for 20 minutes? It was pretty wild. I didn't have any preconceived notions about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had always known it was, I knew Alcoholics Anonymous was a word, right, or two words, and I knew AA was short for Alcoholics Anonymous. Beyond that, I had nothing. I had never, you know, what I thought, never known anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. Turns out, I did, right? We're everywhere. And what stuck with me was, okay, so I go to this meeting, and I don't know if I said I'm new, you could tell, whatever, and you directed the meeting at me, of course, and I'm like, finally someone knows who I am, and you guys came up to me after the meeting and gave me phone numbers and a big book and said keep coming back, and whatever, right? And what stuck out to me was that this woman, January 2nd in Burlington, Vermont, is cold. Cold, cold, cold. And this woman stood outside with me for 2 hours. I have no idea what we talked about, but we stood outside for 2 hours. And for 2 hours, for 2 hours I was being witnessed by another human being, which wasn't happening in the rest of my life. I had this story that I didn't exist, and I collected a lot of evidence to support that. And that's one of the stories that in sobriety you guys are slowly chipping away at, right? And so for the next 6 months, I would come to, I didn't know there are meetings every day. There was a lot of things I didn't know. I didn't know there's a meeting every day that you can go to, or that it suggested you go to a meeting every day. I didn't know anything about a sponsor or what to do with that big book or anything like that. I didn't even know that you shouldn't pick up a drink. I didn't know. I'm sure you guys were saying it, but in the meetings, but I didn't hear that. And so for the next 6 months, I outside issued and drank, and I would, you know, it would get really bad. I would have some kind of crisis, and I would show up to a meeting and be like, when is it going to change? And you guys would be like, keep coming back. And nothing changes if nothing changes, Gwen, you know? And little by slow, I was hearing what makes me an alcoholic, and I was able to see what that looks like in my life. In short, I have no idea when I drink what's going to happen. I have no idea if this is going to be the time that I drink too and I black out. I have no idea if this is going to be the time that I drink all night and I can't get drunk. I have no idea if this is going to be the time that I act like a lady. I have no idea if this is the time that I absolutely don't act like a lady. And I can't predict it. But what I can predict is that I'm going to want more. The second that alcohol gets in my body, I need more, and all bets are off. Any stipulations I'm just going to drink this, like the more about alcoholism paragraph. The first time I read that, I read it and I'm like, oh man, I've done all of it, you know? Trying to juggle my drinking, and all the while I feel like hell. I feel like hell. I can't figure out a reason why I keep waking up. It was very dark when I came in, and for a long time into sobriety, I dealt with that darkness, and you guys kept me coming back, and you said, get a sponsor, so I got a sponsor, and I just had the opportunity to talk with her on the phone before I came in here, and I haven't talked to her in over a year, and we dropped right back in to that incredible spiritual connection that's only possible in this program, and it's so unlikely. We would read paragraph by paragraph out of that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She'd come over to my house at 5:30 on Wednesdays. We would read, and then we would go to our home group, the Williston Work It group. And I didn't want to be there. I thought I was too young. It was boring to me. And she would say, go greet. You guys made me greet. That was the first position you gave me. In service, and service for me has been wildly, it has been integral in keeping me alive and keeping me sober. So we would do that, and there were these little awakenings for me, and I didn't know that's what a word that we use about this stuff, but I remember the first time that I looked at her in her eyes. It was the first human being I'd looked at in the eyes, and I don't know. And I can still see, I remember being like, oh my God, because I looked in her eyes and it was real, it was reality. And then I remember the first time I was able to hear everything she was saying, right? Like I didn't zone out. I was really paranoid when I first came in and you guys were like, just keep coming back, Winnie. It's okay, you know? And little by slow, I started also getting connected into the young people's meetings. And the first young people's meeting I walked into, I saw someone who I had known when I was drinking. She had never been drinking as long as I had known her. And I tried to act like I didn't know her. And she, like you guys do, she came over very gently and said, "Hey, Gwen." And I'm like, oh, who are you? Okay. You know? And and I started getting involved in some young people's things. I am terrified to be around young people. Terrified. And you guys were like, all right, dude, go sit on a committee, you know? And so I got to sit on some committees, and I was really, service and duty and responsibility are a great way for me to connect in with reality. For a long time into sobriety, like I said, I dealt with very deep darkness. I was suicidal at times, and I never thought it was going to pass. It was impossible. That's what I had always felt. That's why I drank. And then when drinking was actively killing me, I had no idea what to do. You guys said, keep coming back. Don't quit till the miracle happens. And I hated that. I hated that because you didn't understand. The miracle was not going to happen for someone like me because it was impossible. And it's happened. It's happened. That darkness has been lifted from me as a result of the framework of recovery that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. I started getting involved in district-level service. I was a GSR, and I would get real wound up. And so you guys were like, well, how about you go to the district? And I started going to district. And a couple of years ago, I was elected the DCM, the district committee member. And it was such an incredibly opening experience that you guys recognized me, not in like a what's up, girl? Way. It was you said this person is dedicated to Alcoholics Anonymous. You gave me the opportunity to serve. And from there, my world has expanded tremendously. I found a family through service. When I was in some of the darkness, I went to a women's retreat. And I knew all the women from that women's retreat from service, right? From area service. And I didn't want to be there. And there was a dinner. And Alcoholics Anonymous is the first place that has helped me to see there is enough. There is enough, and you can keep coming back. And you did it first with your food, right, at the cookouts and stuff. And I was at this women's retreat, and there was this gorgeous dinner. It was in the fall, so it was, you know, butternut squash, the oranges, and the, you know, the yellows and greens. It was a gorgeous dinner. And I was eating, and you know, they said, oh, is that good, Gwen? You can go up and get more if you want, you know. And I say, okay, yeah. And I would see you guys looking at me, just gently. You're carrying on your conversations, but every once in a while, you'd look over and just check on me to see if I was okay. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. You walk the path with me. You don't walk it for me, but you show me how with me. I had the opportunity to go to the General Service Conference dinner, opening dinner this year, and it was, what? Like, I don't even know how this happens. It was so humbling. And what was incredible about that was that it's people. It's people doing this work. Like, I found out, I have no idea how I got to that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was there. It was there. And it was a result of service. That meeting was there, and I didn't kill myself, and I continue to not kill myself because you guys are there. It's so unlikely and impossible, you know? My life has expanded in a way that I didn't want it to. I wanted to die. I believe my disease wants me alone, miserable, and isolated. It'll settle for me dead. And when you take away drinking, I'm left with one choice, to tornado until I die. And you guys keep being that sober wedge, you know? When people say, you're so lucky you came in when you're, you know, so young, it's like, oh my God, I have so many years ahead of me, God willing, you know? But like, oh my God, this is so scary. I don't know what I'm doing. I have no idea what I'm doing. And you guys keep saying the same stuff. It's hungry, angry, lonely, tired, Gwen. Go to a meeting. Call your sponsor. Read some literature. Read a grapevine. I'm real jazzed about the grapevine. You know, say a prayer. Eat some protein. Drink some water. Go to a meeting. Don't pick up a drink. First and foremost, you don't pick up a drink. That was the first thing you taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And now you're teaching me to believe in the goodness of people. You know, I'll close with, I'm able to believe and have faith in people today. In the last meeting that was here, the speaker was asked for her water, and the chair went over and got her water and took the cap off and left it there so that she could drink it. But he took the cap off. He thought enough ahead to take the cap off for her. And it's so minute, right? And yet it's so gorgeous, the light that we bring into other people and how open we're able to be for others to commit these small acts of kindness that build into hope. And you've given me hope, you've given me a life, and I didn't pick up a drink today because of you. Thanks for keeping me sober today.
Thank you, Gwen. That was spectacular. I identified with so much in there. I think the thing I was thinking about the most was when you talked about someone standing out in the cold in a parking lot for 2 hours, and it just brought me back to someone who did the same thing for me when I was new and reminded me that I need to continue to stand out in the parking lot with people and talk to them, proverbially and real, because that's real stuff. Thank you. Thank you. Our final speaker today is Brian O. Brian is from Brooklyn, New York, but lives in the Bronx. Did I get that right, or is it the other way around? Harlem. He's from Brooklyn, but lives in Harlem, which is not in the Bronx. It's in Manhattan. Yeah, okay, I got it. However, we're losing him on the East Coast because apparently he's decided to go west and move to California. So I thought I saw some Californians walk in here. I figured that was going to happen when I said that. Brian was also involved with the International Conference of Young People in Alcoholics Anonymous with the 51st Icky Paw in New York City as their events chair. So a few of us have come from that service heritage. And with that, I'm going to give you Brian, who's going to close us out today.
There we go. Hi, my name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Brian. Love you, Brian. Lots and lots and lots.
Love you back. Thank you. I was afraid that wasn't going to be happening here, but I mean, apparently YPA's repping hard at World. Super excited. I've never been to a world conference before. This is my first time. The last time I was in Atlanta was for Icky Paw. I road tripped with like 8 complete strangers from Long Island who were like, yeah, get in our van. We're going to go. Haley's got the car. We got the hookup. And I was like, all right, cool. I don't know any of you people. I could wind up dead. But all right, let's go. I had such an awesome time. I had a really great time. I've had an amazing time in AA. The most important decision I ever made in my life was to get sober. I know that with every cell of my body. A little bit about me. My sober date is June 28th, 2004. I just celebrated 11 years on Sunday.
Yeah.
I celebrated at the big meeting that happens in New York at the Hilton every year. Shout out to the host committee from Staten Island who hosted that meeting, and shout out to the host committee for this convention. You people are out of your minds to pull this shit together. Seriously, and thank you to everybody who spoke before me. Their messages were really strong and really lovely, and made me just helped me get in touch with my own gratitude for my sobriety and for everybody who came before me and for everybody who's going to come in on fire, cartwheeling, screaming about alcohol with like less than one day sober. You're the people that keep us here. You know, if we don't have anybody to pass this message along to, then, you know, what are we doing? I mean, there's a term for that, but I'm not going to use it because you guys have kept the profanity to a minimum, and I'm going to try to follow suit. So I grew up in Brooklyn. I grew up in Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn. My dad was an alcoholic fireman. My mother was a rageaholic seamstress and educator. I had my first, before I even knew what robo-tripping was, I'd climb the cabinets, I would pull down the Tri-A-Minic, I would drink the whole bottle, and I would hide under my coffee table and watch like Poltergeist or Gremlins or Children of the Corn or whatever my fixation was, Wizard of Oz. You know, I mean, I was obsessed with all these crazy movies, but Wizard of Oz was the one VHS tape that magically disappeared. I think my parents might have figured out that like watching the Wizard of Oz on a loop might make me gay. So that shit just is gone after a while, but damage done. Okay. I didn't get drunk for the first time until I was like 13. My mother was so strict. My mother and I have a lot of the wrong things in common. She was a real control freak. So I didn't get to drink very much, but when I did, I made it count. They also didn't really let me have very much of a social life, because if you gave me an inch, I took the whole damn ruler. And so I drank a little bit in high school, you know. A bottle of liquor and like some ecstasy pills were usually included in whatever prom package we got. I went to a lot of proms because I was the gay kid and I did a lot of the musicals in high school. So the girls were like, you know, I loved that. That was great. I went to an all-boys Catholic high school in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, which is not as sexy as it sounds. Growing up in New York, gay made me feel really, I mean, New York is known as the North in general, is just known as this like liberal place, but you know, it was hard. It was really hard. Being gay, being Latin, from a working class part of Brooklyn, all that stuff. It was just like that pile of that fire that just like I tried to put out with alcohol, those horrible feelings, that self-loathing, the insecurity, all of it. Alcohol helped all of that and made it easier for me to socialize. It made it easier for me to feel what I was feeling. Oh, good God. I mean, it was the 90s, so there was a lot of Tori Amos. There was a lot of Fiona Apple, a lot of Smashing Pumpkins. I was an angry homosexual. Buddy. I went to college. I went to college in Boston. No. It's really hard to get alcohol in Boston if you're underage. And it's really hard to get alcohol in Boston if you have no money. I was one of those kids who had to work for a living, you know? It was weird. I had no idea what wealth was until I got to BU, where, like, those kids were like, I'm depressed. And then, like, out came the credit card and the suite at the Four Seasons and the 8-ball of cocaine. I'm like, is this how you people roll? Really? Like, okay, I'm just, all right. Okay. It was crazy. My major was theater, and it quickly changed to, you know, drinking and drug exploration with a minor in casual sex. It's kind of how I rolled. It was really tough. I had absolutely no tools for dealing with myself. I had no tools for learning how to occupy the skin that I was in. And alcohol really helped with that. After the fall of 01, I left BU. My father survived 9/11 by the hairs of his ass, thankfully, thank God. He lost 7 in his fire engine company, but he survived. And, you know, it was like life was short. I hated Boston. I knew I was spiraling out of control and that I was wasting my money, so I just went home. And I lived out my existence for about a year in a blue bathrobe in my backyard drinking dollar tall boys of Coors Light next to a pool that I'd never covered. So it was like swampy and there were dead squirrels in it. And I smoked pot out of homemade bongs. I lived that way for a year at like 19 years old. I was like, it was like Great Gardens, only like without the turban and the old money. You know, Jackie O wasn't coming by for visits. It was real, and I was 19. That's the whole point. Like at 19, my life had ground to a halt, and everything just kind of stopped. I tried to get sober for the first time when I was 19. I showed up to meetings. I didn't try to get sober at all. And that year was really dark. I tried to get sober again when I was 20, and I stuck around for like 5 months. So in five months of like cruising in and out of young people's meetings, and I tip my thank you, never had a legal drink, thank you, young people step, thank you, yes, those are all the meetings in AA in New York that helped me get my foundation in recovery. Okay, so in 5 months, I got a job. I got a gig producing theater downtown. I had a couple of short things produced. I got a boyfriend. And, like, things were looking good. So I had this checklist of things that I needed to, like, get in my life. And so when all those things happened, when all those things came true, when my life got better, I thought, I got this. I'm good. Thank you, AA. Pass me that joint. And I relapsed. And I learned a really, really important lesson about the fact that, you know, it says in the book, job or no job, wife or no wife, you know, just because things are getting better doesn't necessarily mean that I'm cured. Just because all the externals in my life are starting to look up doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, I'm going to be able to handle a drink. Everything fell apart really slowly. And within a year, I got sober again in 2004, and it stuck. And I looked back at the time that I had been trying to get sober in 2003, and there were some very basic things that I did not do. I did not do 90 meetings in 90 days. I had a sponsor, but I lived to defy him. I did not make an honest attempt at doing the steps. I did not get a home group, and I did not get a service position after I got 90 days. So, service, home group, step work, sponsors, meetings. Those were the five things that I needed to do. Those were the five things that I did when I came in, and that's pretty much the reason I'm still here after 11 years. Thank God for young people's, man. I got scooped up by a gang of rowdy lesbians, and we went to WIPOC conventions. We co-founded meetings. We, you know, saw each other through our romantic entanglements. We did step work. We got sober. It was really great. The wreckage of my life was something that I had a lot of shame about. I thought that I was like you want to talk about the piece of garbage at the center of the universe. I thought that I was like the biggest disaster in every room that I walked into. And I found in recovery that, you know, nobody really cared that I was a mess. You know what I mean? Except like I'm in terms of just like the acquaintances or the people that I went to BU with or whatever. It was like, you know, the longer I stayed sober, the more I learned that I could walk into a room with these tools, with these principles, with my higher power, and I could bring light to it instead of cartwheeling on fire, coming in screaming about methamphetamine. You know, like, I learned that I could carry this message and be a productive member of society, and sobriety has been a huge, huge gift. There was a point in my recovery, I want to say it was about like 5 years in. What happened? I had this gang that I was running with, you know. We would roll into the young people's meetings, big sunglasses, coffee, cigarettes, tight jeans, tits out, no God, no program. Like, awful. Like, none of us were, basically, we were all, like, smoking on the stairs outside the meeting, rolling our eyes at people who were happy, you know. Hating ass bitches. That's who we were. And after 5 years, all those people relapsed. Like, my whole gang went out. And they all went out, like in pieces. It slowly sort of fell apart. And I looked at my own recovery and I thought, okay, what do I need to do? Like, what's happening? Because I think what happened for them was that the same thing that happened for me in 03. Their lives got better and they thought, all right, I got this. And I thought, I've made that mistake already. I don't get to make that mistake again. But also by then, after 5 years, I knew I was an alcoholic. Like, there was the book talks about a lurking notion. There was absolutely no lurking notion that I could drink or drug safely. I tried it. I used to make charts on Monday. You're going to drink a pint of this and you're going to have a tall boy of that. And maybe if supplies, you know, allow some shrooms. Like, it was just, like, awful. Like, and none of that worked. None of that shit worked. So I knew. And so at 5 years, I got the sponsor that I'm still with today, and I just dug deeper. That's one of the beautiful things about, like, staying sober, is that, like, you just have to keep doing the work. There's no graduation. There's no, you're done. There's no real finish line. And that's a beautiful thing. You know, the sponsor that I got was somebody that I was a little bit scared of. He was a straight elevator mechanic from the Bronx. And I was like, that's my guy. I know he knows the book. He's involved in service. I'll listen to him. And here I am. One of the second most important decision I ever made in my life, second to getting sober, was going back to school. I think for the past 4 or 5 years of my life, after having gotten sober, I've gotten my life back. I didn't even get my life back. I got some really awesome life that was so much better than the life that I had when I was drinking handed to me. Because I showed up for it, because I worked, and because I believed in myself. And when I didn't believe in myself, I kept people around who, you know, had lent me their courage. It's been a really challenging time balancing, you know, the life, the blessings, all of it, with staying connected, staying in service, staying in the message, that stuff. I am a control freak. Oh, and like, I've learned that, like, my insecurity and my ambition are like neck and neck to like take me out. Like, those are my like most glaring defects. Those are the things that I have to work on the most in recovery. And the way I sort of combated that was just extending my hand, sponsoring, you know, all the crazy homosexuals that I could, you know, teenage girls who didn't like other girls. I mean, I know you know how that is. Sometimes women don't mix, so they felt safer with me. And that was, I mean, bless them, whatever. You know, however it works. I've had some really awesome experiences taking people through these steps and showing up for my life. I think my family life was pretty wrecked when I got sober, and I think I've had the amazing privilege of repairing and developing really complex and loving relationships with each member of my family. The past few years have been particularly, I'm just going to say it. I feel like over the past few years, like, those last remnants of my childhood kind of fell away and I grew up. I totally all the way grew up. My career kind of took off. Things were great. Hurricane Sandy almost wiped out my mother's house. And my impulse was to show up with, gallons of water, batteries, socks, and my two hands. I put my life on hold and basically helped us dig out that house and rebuild it. Thank God for this program. That was like, well, I can tell you this. If you're new and if you're like, about like, how do I get 11 years, whatever. They told me early on, they said, listen, don't worry about getting through the rest of your life without having a drink. Just worry about getting through the rest of the night. And that was something that I didn't have to hold on to so much anymore, because thanks to doing the steps, the obsession to drink lifted, thankfully. The night I didn't know if my house was still would still be standing was like one of the few times I can count on one hand in the past few years where I actually thought about drinking. And the first thing I did was call my sponsor. And, you know, he just said, show up and help. And that's what I did. And the same thing happened like a year later. The paint was barely drying on the renovations on my house when my dad, all of a sudden it was like, poof, hospice, cancer. He didn't tell anybody because he's a fatalist and an alcoholic. And, you know, 9/11 lung and alcoholism were in a neck and neck race to take my father out. And I swear to God, this program helped me get through. I mean, all I knew to do was just be ready. It was like, where do you want me? What do I need to do? They turned to me at one point and they were like, plan the funeral. And I know that like the part of me, like if I were still using, I wouldn't have even been around. You know what I mean? If I were still using, I'd be hiding under a bed somewhere or in somebody else's bed somewhere. And but instead I was there. I helped plan that funeral. I sent him off with, you know, grace and dignity. I sent him off in a worthy way. And I was able to sort of, there was none of that like Hallmark. The last conversation we had was like, bring me back my car. I need to go grocery shopping. And like the next day he slipped into a coma. So, you know, there wasn't any magic movie moment. But you know what? I know that for me, our relationship had been repaired thanks to the grace of this program and to the strength of everybody who helped me get through that. And I carried myself like a person of grace and dignity. I carried myself like a member of Alcoholics in Good Standing. I brought these principles into every hospital room, you know, into his girlfriend's house, which was weird because, like, who was she? I am really grateful to be sober. I am really grateful to have been blessed with the opportunity to stay and with the opportunity to share my story with you guys today. As this young man to my left mentioned, I am moving to California. My profession has sort of taken me out there to LA. I am terrified. You people who move to new cities when you're like 23, that's the right idea. Don't do it in your 30s. Don't do it after you've like built a life, because it's fucking terrifying. Like, I am scared. Like, I've never been more scared in my life, because New York is my home. New York is all I know. They don't have subways in LA. All they do is drive and eat frozen yogurt. Like, yoga, hiking, what? I don't know. But I also do know, here's what I know. I know that in my professional life and in my recovery life, there are people out there who are waiting for me. There are people out there who are expecting me. I know that I have rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous where I can go. I have sober members in good standing who I know from New York and from my journeys, my travels, what have you, who know to expect me. And I know that it's a huge gift. And I know that the kid who was drinking tall boys of Bud Ice next to a swampy pool in Brooklyn in 2002, if you told that kid that this was what my life would look like, he'd say, yeah, right, fuck out of here. You know what I mean? Like, it would just, it is a life beyond my wildest dreams. And I owe it to Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe the fact that I have been able to withstand the challenges that will fall on all of our shoulders. We're all going to have to deal with it at some point or another. Life. Life's going to get real. This program will get you through it. Don't drink. Trust God. Clean house. Help others. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.